Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. This hour, we'll be talking about the impact of the global fashion industry on the people and places where apparel is produced. Over the past few decades, the fashion industry has changed dramatically. While the vast majority of clothing sold in the U.S. was manufactured here just a few decades ago, now less than 3% of apparel sold in the U.S. is manufactured here. As a result, the price of clothing has plummeted, and U.S. consumers are buying roughly five times the amount of clothing that they did even 20 years ago. Where styles used to change seasonally, they now change over the course of a week in some cases. And this phenomenon of producing inexpensive clothes that quickly come in and out of style is known as fast fashion. And as a provocative new documentary entitled The True Cost reveals, the growth of the fast fashion industry has occurred at a steep cost as clothing manufacturers seek to outsource production in the cheapest labor markets where environmental and worker safety regulations are often lax. So we're going to talk about this topic tonight from three points of view. Our first guest joining us by phone from L.A. is Andrew Morgan. He's director of The True Cost. After studying cinematography at the Los Angeles Film School, he went on to co-found Untold Creative, the film studio where he currently serves as creative director. Welcome, Andrew.
Hey, great to be here.
Joining me here in the studio is Shamini Donna. She is founder of the Earth Conscious clothing line Donna Inc., a certified B Corporation, we'll find out what that means in a moment, and a Green America Gold certified fashion brand for kids and teens. Shamini also serves on the board of directors of the London-based Ethical Fashion Forum and is an associate producer of The True Cost. Oh, welcome, Shamini.
Thank you, and Joseph. Good to be here.
Great. And our final guest by phone is Dr. Dara O'Rourke, who studies the environmental, social, and health impacts of global supply chains. Dr. O'Rourke teaches environmental and labor policy at the University of California, Berkeley, and is co-founder and chief sustainability officer of GoodGuide.com, a comprehensive source of consumer information on the health, environmental, and social impacts of products and companies. Prior to teaching at UC Berkeley, Dara taught at MIT. Welcome, Dara.
Thank you very much, Joseph.
And we invite you, our listeners, as always, to join in our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. It's 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website, or you can post a tweet at cityvisionskalw. So, Andrew Morgan, of the True Cost documentary. I wanted to start with you. You show the entire cycle of clothing production and in its many, many steps from growing of the cotton to the actual production of the clothing to the consumption and then ultimately the disposal of the over-consumed commodity. And I'm curious how you got to want to tell this story. Tell us what got you interested.
Yeah, I was finishing up my last film, and I was getting coffee one morning just over 2 years ago. And I remember looking down at the New York Times that morning, and there was a photograph of these two boys that were similar in age to my boys at home. And they were standing in front of this huge wall of missing person signs. And something in that photograph made me want to pick up the paper. And I read the article that day, along with many people around the world, of the tragic factory collapse at Rana Plaza, just outside of Dhaka, Bangladesh, that took the lives of over 1,000 people. It wasn't that high at that point in the reporting. But I remember standing there reading that article that morning, and, you know, I just kind of had one of those transfixed moments. I realized in that moment that I had never really thought about where my clothes had come from. And, you know, I think growing up in kind of, you know, middle-class America, we went to the store, went to the mall, we bought clothes, and I'd never stopped to think about it. And as I stood there and read that article and read about some of the really, you know, gross effects and huge impact this industry was having, I was just struck, and I wanted to know more. I went back to my office that day and started reading everything I could get my hands on. I started calling some people in different parts of the world that were working in the industry. And by the end of that week, I was convinced that it was a story that I wanted to tell.
So why don't we play a clip from the documentary just to give our listeners a sense of the scale and the scope of what you've put together. And what it does nicely is hit on a lot of the themes that I hope to unpack further over the course of the hour. So let's go ahead and roll that.
We communicate who we are through clothing. It is fundamentally a part of what we wish to communicate about ourselves.
We used to have a system, a fashion system. That has absolutely nothing to do with the fashion industry today. It has been reinvented.
It's based on materialism. The problem is that comes at a really high price.
Garment factory collapsed, killing more than 1,000.
Clashes between clothes factory workers and riot police in Cambodia.
Last November, 112 people were killed in another major factory fire.
30,000 Chinese workers have been on strike.
Garment workers in Bangladesh are paying the price for cheap clothing.
The promise of globalization was that it was going to be a win-win, that consumers in the rich world would get cheaper goods and people in the poorer parts of the world would get jobs, and that those jobs would give them an opportunity to work their way out of poverty.
This enormous, rapacious industry that is generating so much profit, why is it that it is unable to support millions of its workers properly?
The actual business model is completely unsustainable. Unless you change that model, you can't change anything.
When everything is concentrated on making profits, what you see is that human rights, the environment, workers' rights get lost.
My God, we can do better than this.
So that is a clip from the movie that was just released last month, The True Cost. And we have on our show this evening the maker of that film. That was Andrew Morgan. And Andrew, the sound is just as striking as the visuals that you captured there. Tell us how you were able to access the people and the places to be able to tell this story.
Yeah, well, I think one of the first things that my producer and I both agreed on, you know, when we were developing the film originally, it was at a moment where Rana Plaza certainly, and a couple of the incidents before that, but especially Rana Plaza, were kind of featured, you know, in the news cycle. And, you know, we made a choice early on to tell a story and make a film that really had a global focus. And by that I mean, we wanted to follow this industry as it operates all over the world so that it wasn't just a Bangladesh film, because it's not just a Bangladesh issue. And so that very quickly meant that we kind of mapped out a pretty aggressive production schedule that ended up taking us to 13 countries. And in each of those countries, one of the first and most important things that we had to do was just connect with local people on the ground. Sometimes they were journalists, sometimes they were fixers. And I spent a lot of time just communicating the heart and the soul of the film that we were trying to make. Because it's a funny thing to come into someone else's country and say, you know, I'm really looking for some of the ugly stuff, you know. And you really have to get that person to trust, you know, why you're telling the story. But once those people bought into that, once they got what we were trying to do, there was just no limit to what they would do for us in terms of access to factories, protection during some really dangerous incidents, and also they then would help us get the trust of some of the other people that were featured in the film, including workers and folks like that. So they were pretty key in that regard.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more in a little bit about what it was like for some of those workers to come in front of a camera and what kinds of risks they may have taken on to be able to do that. Before I go there, I wanted to bring Dara O'Rourke from UC Berkeley into the conversation. Dara, you've been researching this issue for a long time. It seems like the Rana Plaza factory collapse in April of 2013, you know, put this front and center for us, but this has been going on for quite some time. In fact, you co-authored a book back in 2001 entitled "Can We Put an End to Sweatshops?" Tell us how long has this issue been going on? And if you could, just try to kind of give us a sense of the scale and what are the things that sustain it? We heard a little bit about that in the clip I just played, but just give us a sense of all the pieces that sustain this kind of situation.
Absolutely. And this sadly, the catastrophe, the tragedy of Rana Plaza was horrific but not surprising, quite frankly. And Rana Plaza, I think, was kind of the most egregious example, the worst disaster in the apparel industry in the last 100 years. But it really was a symptom of a system that led Rana Plaza ultimately to collapse under the downward pressure of the global apparel industry. And this really has been going on since the 70s, this system of outsourcing production in which U.S. brands and European brands and retailers have driven a transformation in the global apparel industry and now the global toy industry, the global electronics industry, multiple other industries, which have led to this downward pressure. And fast fashion is a fairly recent example of this, but certainly not the only part of the problem. And it's not just the fast fashion. It's also slow fashion, sadly. And it's not just H&M and some of the examples that Andrew told a very compelling story in his film, but also it's Walmart, it's Gap, it's JCPenney, it's Children's Place, it's mainstream apparel that we all benefit from, that are low costs, and we support often. And so we basically have seen this trend over the last 30 years of a very systematic outsourcing of production, but also an outsourcing of responsibility, of brands and retailers putting several arm's length worth of responsibility between them and these workers. It is an intentional system of outsourcing production and outsourcing the employment of workers, the payment of workers, the treatment of workers, that has been phenomenally profitable for U.S. brands and retailers and European brands and retailers. And the reason that they are in places like Bangladesh is really only because of the low labor costs, artificially low labor costs. Bangladesh has no cotton, it has no polyester, it has no technology in the apparel industry, it has horrible ports, it has corrupt red tape in and out of the country. So basically, the U.S. brands and European brands are there benefiting off of the massive profit margins that they are able to extract from Bangladesh and from the workers of Bangladesh. So we basically have a system. And when you said, let's lay out the full thing has many different people to blame in it, and we are one of them. We as consumers and we as citizens are one part of that, but we're not the only part of it. So there are irresponsible factory managers. There are under-resourced building inspectors. There are conflicted and sometimes corrupt government officials up and down these supply chains. But then there also are us, and us as we are connected to the brands and retailers we support every day, and us as consumers in making decisions. And the industry has basically made this argument that we deserve and need, you know, men's dress shirts for $7.99 or women's dresses for $9.99. You go into these stores and you literally can't believe the price because it is so low. And in the apparel industry, we've seen continuous downward pressure on prices. As you mentioned at the start of the show, increased speed of fashion cycles. It used to be there were 5 fashion seasons in the U.S. Now there, for many of these stores, there's 13. Some are at 26. That is all new products in their stores every 2 weeks. So the styles are changing very rapidly, and it is almost like we are at throwaway clothing. And this, of course, has massive impacts on workers, on communities, and the environment up and down these supply chains, which I think Andrew did a very powerful job in telling that story.
So you mentioned consumers, you mentioned manufacturers, the government, where these factories exist, the companies themselves. I think you make a point in your film, Andrew, of also pointing to advertisers and the images of that they sell of what kinds of things could happen to you in the positive sense if you were to engage in this kind of consumerism, and you know, and the other part of the other kind of overarching theme there is capitalism, and the capitalist mechanism is what's driving all this. It feels like because there are and then there's the point of view that I'd like to talk more about, Andrew, that you got from the companies about the workers themselves, and that they're kind of part of this system, and that, you know, this is and they, you know, this, they're there by in some ways by choice, or that this is the best choice that they have. Tell us a little bit about what kinds of responses you got from companies when you asked them how they can be involved in this kind of set of human rights and environmental abuses.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a lot of ways, we didn't get a lot of response from companies. A lot of the brands and retailers that we approached, declined to be a part of the film. But when I did talk to them, and when I did talk to them, some of them off the record too, I think what they echoed, by and large, is a very traditional free market story that I've been told here in the States. I was told it as a child. You know, I feel like we're kind of told this very, very simple story, and the story at its heart says, yes, there might be exploitation in these supply chains. Yes, there might be horrendous conditions. Yes, these jobs might be, really terrible, but even if you're in a job and a factory's collapsing on top of you, that job is better than no job at all. And that central idea, that oversimplified notion has actually had incredible staying power. That's lasted a long time. And I think what we're trying to explore in the film is just this idea that while, yes, they do need these jobs, and yes, work is vitally important in these countries, doing the very least we can do maybe isn't the best we can do. And it's always been kind of put in this very simplistic equation where it's like either we pull out of production in these countries and leave these people worse off than they were, or we continue this exploitive way of paying less than a living wage and, not looking after proper safety measures and on down the list. And I just think there's a third viable option. I think there's a third viable option that says this is an industry that records profit to a tune that makes other industries jealous. And there's a lot on the table here, and it just isn't going down to the bulk, the largest part of its workforce.
Dara O'Rourke, could you put some numbers to that? What's the profits like at most of these clothing companies, and if you could benchmark it compared to other industries?
Yeah, so in general, this industry has, first of all, a wide range of types of firms, and some operate on razor-thin margins. So a lot of the really, really low-cost stuff, like the apparel you find in a Walmart, has tiny margins, which is part of the reason there's so much pressure downward on price. Literally shaving off pennies per T-shirt is the business model for that end. But then there's also the very high end of the apparel industry, the luxury market, where people pay $100 for a very similar T-shirt, but that has the right brand on it, that is the brand of the day. So we've got some parts of it that are phenomenally profitable, huge margins, and other parts of it that are razor thin and are constantly looking for the next Bangladesh to squeeze just a little bit further out. But this is tens of billions of dollars in sales in the U.S. alone. Some of these firms are privately held, so they don't disclose their profits, but you have firms that are publicly traded that are multi-billion-dollar firms per year in apparel here in the U.S. and that are growing very nicely and that are continuing to grow and expand, and we see sales growing. And it really is an industry that, despite profits, continues to be at the forefront of this global strategy of finding one new place that they can eke out a little bit more profit. And after the Rana Plaza tragedy, in talking to people in the industry that I called up, they really, they didn't want to be in Bangladesh, but literally their sourcing teams were telling them the margins are too good. We can't not be in Bangladesh. It's just too good. And now we're seeing firms like The Gap have announced that they're moving on to Burma. Now, Burma is the new frontier, Myanmar, of the even lower labor costs, even less labor regulation, and we're seeing some return to Africa also for apparel, global apparel production. So it's a very profitable global industry that is somehow intensely focused on finding even more profit and finding, because so much of the margin is in the labor part of it. This is, interestingly, one of the few industries that we have not figured out how to automate. It's very difficult to automate the sewing of fabric. So we still see this kind of intense focus on bringing down the cost of labor brought into these systems and really continuing to focus on squeezing workers. as a part of a business model.
Just in case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing the true cost of cheap clothing, or as it's known these days, fast fashion. We're opening our phone lines to you to join in on our questions and with questions and comments for our guests. Does knowing where or how your clothes are made affect your purchasing decisions? The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You could also email or text us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or you could tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Shamini Dhana, you're here in the studio with me, and you are founder of the Earth Conscious Clothing line, Dhana Incorporated, and also on the board of directors of London-based Ethical Fashion Forum. You've been scribbling a lot of notes here. I'm curious to hear about what your thoughts about this topic are tonight as we have been slowly unpacking it.
Yeah, thank you, Joseph. You know, I think one of the striking points that I got away from this conversation so far is that the desire or the need to actually respect all life form or all humankind along the way and actually to honor these people along the way. And this is what I see lacking in terms of fundamental, you know, basic respect when it comes to either, you know, whether it's product in what you use at the home or even in fashion, right? So why is it that we don't have that fundamental need to actually respect all of humankind when we actually are wearing something that reminds us every day that there are hands and hearts behind it? And that, I think, is the missing link. The minute you can actually touch, do all those touch points, then you really will get to the crux of this matter, that we actually care in the essence.
So humanizing this,
exactly,
would be the way to get this to change. Andrew Morgan, what did you expect from? I mean, I know your documentary has only been out for a little bit, but what do you expect to come of it? You know, is consciousness raising? Do you see that as turning the tide on this? One thing I noticed in your film, you did portray the consumer madness that's out there, showing a video of, you know, day after Thanksgiving sales and people rushing the doors, or people posting their YouTube videos on the latest, is it fashion haul that they just engaged in?
Shopping halls, yeah.
Shopping hall, there you go. But what I didn't see you talking to those consumers directly and sort of getting a sense of how they would respond. Would they have known what was behind the clothing that they bought? Was there a conscious decision there not to include that in the film? Or tell me more.
Well, you know, I think in a lot of ways I made the film for myself. I made the film for someone who's never thought about these ideas before, and I made the film as an effort to really launch a larger global conversation with people. Not just like your guests here tonight who have been working on these issues for a long time. I'm anxious to see this conversation move out into more of the mainstream. And I think, you know, in regards to consumer, I think what's really important for me in the film and as we talk about the film is this is not designed to make people feel guilty. I think in a lot of ways we've been told a story here in America that has cast us by and large in the role of the consumer. And you mentioned advertising earlier, but I think it's bigger than just advertising. It's an entire way of helping people see their role or one of their primary roles or values in society as being someone who takes in stuff. And when that's your role, when that's the value that you bring to the equation, it leads people to kind of seeing themselves as just standing at the end of this large global conveyor belt that brings them products. And it has led us to a place of giving away, as Dara said, giving away or outsourcing the responsibility of the things that we buy. So I think the film, to me, is just an invitation to say, you know what, there's actually real impact made by our choices, and there's an opportunity here. There's a really rich, meaningful opportunity here to begin to connect some of the choices we make every day with some of the values that we've built our lives around. And I have to say, over the last couple of years, coming from never thinking about this before, this has made my life a lot more meaningful, and I think the potential here is for people to really just become aware of something that they hadn't really considered before. And that's my goal. My goal is to make this a household conversation, to make clothing something about that, something we talk about in the same way that we talk about food, in the same way that consciousness, you know, continues to expand in other ways.
Well, it's interesting because you said that, you know, consumers are kind of abdicating responsibility, but could you imagine consumers thinking that it is their responsibility somehow to consume in order to kind of turn the engine, the economic engine, in other parts of the world? Do you see that that's sort of is potentially part of this maybe a subconscious incentive?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's part of the opportunity here. Is, you know, Stella McCartney says in the film, you know, she says this great line. She says, you know, if you don't like it, don't buy into it. And I think we lose sight of the fact sometimes that we actually do cast votes with our dollars. And, you know, that can sound simple when you're staring down a huge industry like this, but the only way anything changes, I think, is when it begins to seep into our very personal and practical choices. And that's why this has been such a phenomenal story to tell for me, is I think we're at this point in human history where we're more aware than ever of some of the large, real, serious threats facing humanity, and yet it can feel overwhelming. It can feel like, how in the world am I going to actually make a difference on extreme poverty or climate change? And I think what we need next is to begin to connect the dots between these huge issues and some practical ways we can make adjustments on a small level every day.
Just like the pennies, people are trying to shave off the prices of clothing. I want to go to a caller here. Starchild from San Francisco, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to make the point that, you know, I think we're also told a story about guilt, and I know you guys saying, you know, that he's not trying to make people feel guilty with film, and I respect that, but you know, it really is, I think, good for people that companies are moving in. I mean, the companies seek out the areas where there's the most poverty, right? And because that's where labor costs are lowest. But by doing that, by bringing jobs to those places, over time, those places get so the workers are paid better there. And that's why, as you mentioned, people moving from, you know, a place like China and, you know, to Bangladesh, and then Bangladesh to Burma, and so on. And the one problem, though, is that workers don't have the same freedom to move around that capital does. I mean, we need to bring down the immigration barriers that prevent people from competing equally as workers, because when money can cross borders but workers can't, then it puts labor at a disadvantage.
Thank you so much for your call. So, Daryl Rourke, I wanted you to respond to that comment, this notion that, you know, the whole reason why The Gap or other companies are now moving on to Burma is that, in fact, you know, working conditions have improved, that making these margins are not quite as profitable, so you got to move on to the next place. Is that how it works? Do you really see such a tied in connection between these pieces?
I guess I would say there's several different parts of the global apparel industry and other industries as well, and I think the main part of the industry, I would just say, is not following that. So the global industry in general is not just looking for the cheapest wages. If they were, then all production would be in sub-Saharan Africa or in the Dominican Republic. They'd look for the cheapest, lowest cost labor all the time. But what in general they're looking for are the most productive, high quality, and low cost factories in the world. And that, over the last 20 years, has meant China. And China is the number one producer of apparel by far. Bangladesh is number two. And so China is not the cheapest wages by far. So, you know, Bangladesh is now at about $68 a month. China is easily $200 to $300 per month for labor, much more than many other countries in Asia and in Africa. And so they produce something called full package production. It's super efficient, just high enough quality to meet U.S. consumer demands, delivered very quickly. They've got good ports, they've got transportation, they've got infrastructure, they've got IT. So they're able to produce and be more competitive than anyone else. And it's not just about cheap labor or cheap resources. There is, though, then a part of the industry that is chasing that and is just driving down on T-shirts, super low-tech, simple products that have not much kind of worker skill in it. And we see that in some parts of the industry where you'll see kind of the lowest end following that pathway downward. Unfortunately, that is a piece of the part that we all touch up against, our T-shirts, our socks, our underwear, the kind of low-end pieces of it. So, again, we have to look kind of carefully at these different types of firms and brands. And often the fast fashion, the really fast fashion stuff, where you would have kind of women's blouses in an H&M or a Zara or a Uniqlo, is not going to be only in places like Bangladesh. It's going to be all around the world. They need to get it into market really quickly. They need to have pretty high-quality factories that can do quick style changes. So there's a lot going on. Now, to Starchild's point about kind of the that this can help to alleviate poverty, I think, you know, there really is a part of the story in which all of us, I think, support this idea that there is a real opportunity to create jobs, and as Andrew said in the film, the promise of the global economy is that it would lift all boats and that it would offer economic opportunity to people around the world, particularly in the poorest countries. But what we see over and over again is not a kind of natural development process of a country like Bangladesh or now Myanmar or Cambodia, but rather multinational firms repeating the mistakes that they have inflicted on other countries and repeating poor environmental practices, poor labor practices, exploitative practices. And so this is not just, well, Cambodia has to go through these steps of development. This is very profitable global firms applying the same model onto those countries and causing the massive externalities, the injuries, the accidents, the pollution, the toxics, the birth defects that were pointed out in the film that are happening over and over again. And those are not natural, and those are not what we would hope for in a global economy of 2015.
And tell us what you think about the fact that this out-migration of the companies, what happens to those countries afterwards? So what's going to happen to Bangladesh now that companies are moving on to Myanmar?
Yeah, and China first. I mean, China is now seeing kind of huge problems in the apparel industry, lots of factories leaving, workers losing jobs, being cheated out of the wages as these factories close down, big controversies, wildcat strikes, protests in China around the departure of factories and factory managers basically leaving without paying them their fair due or any kind of severance or anything. So we're seeing this. This is not just kind of jobs being lost in the U.S. There's now massive job losses in China. And, you know, one other one which we're studying now is there is mass automation coming to many of these industries that have been key employers of workers in developing countries. So we are now seeing huge investments in the automation of electronics manufacturing, toy manufacturing, and apparel is coming. So we are going to see another massive disruption, and this one kind of pathway out of poverty for agricultural workers moving to cities, taking labor-intensive jobs, moving up this kind of ladder, that in the next 5 to 10 years really is going to be in question. And that's going to put countries like Bangladesh in huge risk, where they have depended so much on export production of apparel and really just adding labor to these global firms. So there's huge potential social risk in this, and risk for these people's lives and for political stability and social stability in these countries. And this, you know, the global economy, global capitalism, is a continuous job destroyer and job creator. And it is going on right now, even in Silicon Valley, right? These firms disrupt other firms and people lose jobs. At the global scale, this is massive disruption and destruction of jobs, and then some creation of jobs also. So we're definitely going to see that and have really potential severe impacts. And the types of protests that Andrew showed in his film, we're going to see more and more of those around the world.
This is City Visions on 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're talking about the apparel industry and issues around workers and environmental impacts of the fast fashion industry with our guests, Andrew Morgan, who is the director of the True Cost documentary that came out last month, Shamini Dhana, who is founder of the Earth Conscious clothing line Dhana Incorporated. And just then, we were hearing from Dr. Dara O'Rourke of UC Berkeley. If you want to join our conversation this evening, 415-841-4134 is the number to dial. Perhaps you work for one of the large apparel companies based in the Bay Area. Call us and weigh in with your perspective on the changes to the fashion industry. 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment to the KLW website. Or tweet us at City Visions KALW. So, Shamini Dhana, I wanted to come back to you because you are an example of someone who's trying to do this differently. Tell us a little bit about your business model at Dhana Inc. What is a certified B Corporation, by the way?
Yeah, so the B stands for Benefit Corporation. And what it is, it's basically a new movement of businesses that basically feel, know, do that business can be used as a force for good of the world. And in that, the impetus to doing what they do is to address the social and environmental challenges. So businesses actually are there to play a part. And so it's triple bottom line. So it's not only just getting profits, as we talked about, but you have to address both people and planet as part of your mandate. And so Dhana happens to be a company founded on these value systems. The reason why I started the company is because from the get-go, there was a clear realization that clothing is something that we put on ourselves every day, and that it's an ability to connect with people and planet through our clothes. And the focus for Dhana has been always educating our young, our youth, because they're the global ambassadors of tomorrow. And so if we can actually make them more aware, make them realize that they actually have a choice, have an ability to impact with clothing, then by right, they would definitely make the smarter choice, more conscious as they grow older when they have the purchasing power. And there lies in our tagline that we're wearing the world. Right. So from the very get-go, we decided that it had to be sourced from ethical sources. We partnered with Fairtrade International. We only use 100% GOTS certified cotton.
What's that mean? GOTS certified cotton.
It has a standard, and it is a cotton that is not conventional. It's organic cotton, which doesn't use any kind of herbicide or pesticides, right? And because we started from the get-go, we were a small brand, and so we can do that. But that said, the brands are actually moving towards this scenario. The big ones want to adopt this value system, and the reason being very simple. They see it in the food. There's a whole lifestyle change that is happening across the U.S. And, you know, what food was 15 years ago, fashion is following suit. And so you will start seeing that trend. And brands like myself and others are just doing it from the get-go, that is trying to make a most impact from with as least, you know, I would say, not damage, but in terms of getting people to understand that, you know, you have to make the conscious choice from the get-go.
And how about the manufacturing? How do you certify, so to speak, that mm-hmm. that the workers' conditions are appropriate?
Yeah. So our factory, actually, we source it from India, is a certified fair trade factory. And so it's from an independent body, so it's Fairtrade International that certifies it. When we use Fairtrade certified cotton wherever possible, including GOTS, what that means is from the time the cotton is picked all the way to the spinning, yarning, the cut and sew, all the workers that come through that supply chain, they're treated with a fair minimum wage and with the rights, and they're honored that way. And so,
what is the wage, that the average wage of the workers that that sew your clothing compared to the average wage of a worker?
Yeah, so
in India,
this is a worker. This is a misconception of a lot of people. They think that just because it's fair trade and got certified cotton, you're paying huge amounts of markup. It's not. It's actually anywhere between 20%, maybe 25%. But what you're doing is you're directly impacting the community now, because you're transferring that to the workers versus anywhere else. And so it's not luxury. It's not luxury that you can't, you know, feel or touch. You literally can get a piece of clothing, a T-shirt, for anywhere from $15, $20, $25 now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, but do you know how much the workers are making?
I do.
How much are they making?
They make as much as, you know, they should be making in India.
You won't tell us. Well, I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
Yeah.
I am. But I'm trying to get at this issue, mm-hmm. of what is the difference between prices that support a living wage and prices that don't. Mm-hmm. So that we can get a sense of, really, how much are we talking here, mm-hmm. In terms of how much would clothing prices have to go up to really get at some of these issues.
Right.
So this is why I'm pressing you on this
right.
point.
And so, as Dara says, you know, it's, you know, China, you can possibly get, you know, something from 200 per month, mm-hmm. right, for a living wage. I think we're above that for sure. We're more like in the 400 odd. And then the factory that we actually... source from, interestingly enough, it's heavily women dominated. This is the other thing, that the resources are not available to many women, who, and many of them are actually of child, are single mothers. And so when you have factories like that, geez, you know, you're actually supporting one more thing, which is moms who really want to take care of their kids. And then with that wage, they actually are able to have an education system. And you're supporting their community at large. And the other thing that I'm pretty proud to say about the factory that we work with, it's a zero-waste factory. So nothing actually goes to waste. A lot of it in the cotton, you know, gets to be transferred back to nonprofits. So these are sort of the points that most consumers don't hear. Our customers, you know, want to know what we're actually about, you know, as a brand, what we're advocating for.
And you said the average price of your T-shirt is like $15 to $25. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So back to you, Dara O'Rourke. Tell us, give us some more of a sense of what, if there were going to be some shifts in this, besides what Andrew mentioned earlier, which is people voting with their feet and not buying from places that don't treat their workers well, how much would clothing prices have to change to really revolutionize this industry? And what can you predict would be the impact on companies and if they had to raise prices?
Yeah, so I think I'm doing some work right now on this question of a living wage in apparel supply chains and in electronic supply chains, and there are a number of nonprofits around the world and academics that are studying in each country and even within each region with its countries. The living wage is calculated based on kind of what the costs of living are, and the cost of living in Shanghai is very different than the cost of living in rural China and different mm-hmm. parts of Bangladesh, different. There's a group called the Asia 4 Wage Coalition, which has tried to set that and determine it across countries, and we're involved in some research on that. Often the living wage is two times or three times the minimum wage in these countries. The minimum wage, which, as I mentioned, in Bangladesh, was about $37 per month through massive protests and organizing. They raised it to about $68, but still below what I think any serious person would determine as a living wage, something that allows them to meet their basic needs, support one dependent, have a little bit for savings, for health care, et cetera. And so there's pretty good formulas for how you would determine this and what it would cost. Now, that said, even if you doubled the wages to workers in many of these factories, labor still is a small percentage of the actual cost of production. So maybe there is $1 of labor in your tennis shoe, or I think even in an iPhone, maybe $1.60 to $1.80 of labor in an iPhone out of the total purchase price. So I think you could significantly increase wages. And we're doing research right now in Thailand in apparel factories to try to simultaneously increase wages while increasing the productivity in these factories through just better management and some training and treating workers more fairly, giving them voice, giving them the ability to participate. That I think there is the real potential to transform this industry and many others so that you are not going downwards in this low road sweat workers model of the last 30, 50, 100 years, but rather you are treating workers as humans, as serious human capital and contributors to your production. You treat them well, you provide them humane jobs, you give them the opportunities to participate in problem solving and productivity enhancing things. We think you could significantly double wages in many of these industries and not have to raise the prices very much at all, maybe 5 to 10%, but not 20 or 30 or even doubling. So I think there is the potential on this to transform these industries. Now, right now, the industry is not organized to do it. It is not organized to maximize wages for workers. It's organized to maximize margin for the firms at the very tops of these supply chains. The real profit-making is in the brands and the retailers and in the marketing and advertising people that are peripheral to it. So we really would have to think about how to shift the power in these industries towards focusing on the people that are really doing the hard work of producing our garments and getting them the voice that they could then participate in demanding their fair share. Now, I think to your second question, consumers really can play a role in this. And I think we have a clear track record in the U.S. of consumers, and including small numbers of consumers, that we have seen, you know, the fair trade movement really emerged out of churches in the U.S. asking to, where did our coffee come from that we're serving on Sundays? Could we get coffee that we didn't feel bad about? And they helped drive the fair trade coffee market. College students in the 90s drove the anti-sweatshop movement. A small group of kind of health-focused people have driven the organics movement. We can have small numbers of consumers can play a role, and they can make a difference in doing a couple things. They can first demand to know more. And this, I think, you know, the awareness that is being raised by Andrew and by Shamini and their work, I think, is really critical. Consumers should be asking, where does this shirt come from? How is it made? What are the impacts? And they should, when they walk into H&M or Zara or The Gap, they should be asking those questions. They should be demanding much greater transparency. You asked a question, what would consumers do if they knew where their things came from? Unfortunately, right now, it's almost impossible for a consumer to know. They can only know country of origin. They can't really know what factory or what the conditions or what the workers were paid. So we really need consumers and citizens. We need to move from being passive consumers to active citizens demanding greater transparency over these supply chains, over brands, over retailers. And then I think the second step is we've got to make decisions. How do we vote with our dollars? We can either stop buying, but we have to do it loudly. We have to send a message to these firms that we are choosing not to buy their products because of these issues, so they hear it. Or we need to continue buying, but to also do it loudly and to demand, you know, I love your brand, I love your product, I want to wear it, but I want to feel good about wearing it. I want to support a brand that supports its workers and that cares about them and is transparent and is investing in them. And so whether or not you decide to boycott or boycott, I think you need to do it loudly. And in this day and age, it's don't send an email to the company, don't write them a letter. It is tweet about it. It is Instagram about it. It's Snapchat about it. It's put it out in the public debate that you care. Take a picture of that price tag that says $7.99 for a dress and ask your friends, how is it possible that this is $7.99? Ask the company, how is it possible? What were the workers paid? Push on those questions, Joseph, that you just pushed on in a way that makes the conversation move towards brands realizing that they can do better and have a better relationship with their customers if they take these things seriously.
Shamini, you wanted to say a couple of things there.
Yeah, I think it's all really good points here. You know, I foresee very soon the industry changing, the apparel industry changing, when you have something called nutritional labeling for fashion. You have something now for food, for sure. I mean, when a consumer can actually go in and look at the food and it sees all the ingredients. But what if You know, you have that labeling, and literally, not only whether it's polyester or in terms of the ingredients, whether it's cotton, but the cause behind it. Is it fair trade? Is it, you know, what kind of dyes are they using? Is it vegan? Is it something that, you know, it stands for, you know, basically the aligning the values between the customer and the end consumer. So that's one. Definitely I see that coming. And with that, it's all about technology, right? So giving a voice, not only for the consumers, but, you know, there are more and more workers on the fields of the developing countries that have mobile phones than anywhere else in terms of its growth, right? So you can actually see one day in the near future whereby the consumer, all he or she has to do is not only just tweet or Snapchat or, you know, take a photograph, but be able to be linked to the workers, you know, in a capacity that will have dialogue going both ways. And whoever decides to be the conduit to perform this service, you know, is going to probably make a name for him or herself. That's coming. Whether we like it or not, the consumer and the worker is going to happen. There are brands today that actually have the ability to share the artisans behind it. There's indigenous designs who are foremost in their tools. They call it the trace tools. And they're doing this already. And they're absolutely ethical, fair trade brand as well. So it's coming.
Hmm. I want to get to a couple of callers. We got Andre in San Francisco. Andre, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, I'm listening to your show kind of bemused. I like to recycle things, and one thing I like to do is I like to go shopping for clothes at the Salvation Army or Goodwill. And that made me think, well, all of this fast fashion, all of this hunger people have for new clothes or, you know, the new style, what is happening with all of the clothes they no longer want?
I think we're going to ask Andrew Morgan that question because he addresses that in the documentary. I'm going to have you take your answer off the air. Thanks for your call. Andrew.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and it's a very logical question, right, to say, wow, we're bringing in, you know, 400% more clothes into our lives than we were two decades ago. You know, as a world, we're consuming 80 billion pieces of new clothing a year. And I got to that place where I said, wait a second, where does that go? Like, you know, it's coming in our wardrobe faster. It's going out of our wardrobe faster. And, you know, one of the obvious places is it is going to landfills. The average American throws away about 82 pounds of textile waste. That's per person, and that adds up to about 11 million tons from the U.S. alone. And a lot of that's non-biodegradable. So on the pure waste factor, I mean, I was in landfills in countries all over the world where it really did stretch out as far as the eye could see, just mountains and mountains and mountains of clothing and textile waste. But one of the interesting things that your caller brought up is that idea that, you know, we donate our stuff to charity shops or thrift shops. And I've always done that. Like, I don't actually throw it in a trash can. And it was an amazing thing for me to learn that about one out of every 10 items that gets donated to charity gets sold here locally in our thrift stores. And the rest is sent overseas, in a lot of cases, ending up in developing economies, sold, not given, but usually always sold, and then resold on the streets of some of these countries. And in the film, we filmed in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, where they have just an enormous Pepe secondhand clothing market that's had a really decimating effect on the local industry there. And there's a lot of complexity to that. But the bottom line issue is that at the end of the day, there's a consumption volume question here. And there's a problematic scenario, no matter how you factor it, of us beginning to view clothing as a disposable item. It doesn't matter how much good technology is coming. It's not here yet. We are actually doing tremendous damage. And I think, you know, one of the things that we're trying to communicate in the film is, like, I don't want anyone to think, you know, I need to not love the things I wear. I think it's more of a move back to investing in clothing that we really do love. Like, let's go to a place again where clothing and fashion is something that we cherish and hold on to. Because no matter how it was made, that infinitely is a more sustainable step on this side.
And I will just lastly say,
over the last 2 years, I have been buying secondhand just as I've wanted to kind of step back and understand what I'm buying into. And certainly purchasing secondhand and reusing and swapping and all those things are, to your caller's point, a great a great thing to do on the consumer side.
But
too.
The overload is so huge that it's just it would take us forever to kind of work through all that clothing, and most of it's, as you say, in landfills at this point. So that's beyond our reach at this point. I want to go to another caller, Marie Louise from Palo Alto. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening.
I am thinking of a time some years back when I spent 4 or 5 years when I bought absolutely nothing that came from China, and the reason for that was because of the way that the Tibetans were treated. And, you know, I don't think I made a heck of a lot of impact on that, but what it did was that, you know, everyone I knew and every place I went, if I was purchasing something, I checked where did it come from. And so in that way, I think it did give a message, you know, that I paid attention to where things came from. And so that was just one part of what I kind of wanted to say. And the other way is that I think it would be great if we could come up with some kind of slogan, and I don't have it in my head tonight. I'm so appreciative of what you've said so far, but I think we need some kind of slogan about, you know, low price, high cost, or in human labor, something like that. You know, I haven't finalized it, obviously. But anyway, so that is my thought, because, you know, a slogan, it spreads fast also. So
thanks so much for your call, Marie Louise. We have a couple of minutes left. You know, I just realized that we didn't even touch on the environmental degradation of this industry. And I'm thinking I want to invite the three of you back to the program to do a whole hour just on that. And Dara, I feel like we didn't talk about how the fashion industry may be responding. There's an alliance built in here in America and an accord in Europe that is trying to address some of the issues in Bangladesh. There's been a lot of questions about the impact that these corporations are having on those working conditions. Tell us a little bit about that. By the way, we tried to get a representative of the alliance on the program tonight. We weren't successful with that. Dara, could you tell us a little bit there?
Very quickly, I think out of this tragedy in Bangladesh and this kind of realization about the horrible conditions in the lowest end of the low road industry, we saw a response from industry. First from European brands and retailers, they created something called the Accord, and then U.S. brands and retailers launched something called the Alliance. Both basically are beginning to build systems around worker safety, around fire safety, and building safety. So this is not about wages and hours, not about labor rights or human rights or women's rights. This is really just, can we stop the tragedies from continuing and kind of start to begin to build a foundation on top of this tragedy? This is very hard, very slow, very expensive, painstaking work that is really trying to build a new infrastructure of safety and accountability, and in the case of the Accord, some participation. So the Accord, I think, really a very interesting effort to begin to do serious inspections of these factories, and not the kind of corporate-controlled inspections, but serious independent inspections, publicly transparent reports. You can look at the website. If you Google Bangladesh Accord or Bangladesh Alliance, you'll find these pictures of factories, the corrective action plans they need to take, the timelines, worker participation in this, really unique. And really the most critical, unique thing is these are binding commitments. The brands have to actually pay to improve conditions. They can't just cut their contract when they find out that.
Okay, we're going to have to stop there. Andrew, tell us how people can link to your documentary.
Yeah, if people go to truecostmovie.com, they can find all the ways to see it. It's available on iTunes, Amazon, directly from the site there, and also on DVD and Blu-ray, and it's in 19 languages, so pretty much anywhere, or about in 80 countries right now around the world, people have access to it.
Thanks. And Shamini Donna, how can people learn more about the work you're doing?
Yeah, our website is donna.com, DHANA.com.
Great. I want to thank all three of my guests, Shamini Donna, Dara O'Rourke, and Andrew Morgan, for joining me this evening. To let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper. We'll be off next week. Join my co-host David Onick on July 13th as he explores the question of what we should be eating during a drought. I'll be away for for a few weeks. See you in August. This is Joseph Pace. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.